Yes.
Hi, everyone. This is Dean Haglund in the offices of Rational Exuberance in the heart of the historic core of downtown Los Angeles in the middle of the Art Deco window known as the Eastern Columbia Building. This is your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, and I'm here with my co-host, Mr. Phil Lernes.
And I need to prep one more note here so that you just fly solo for a minute.
Really? Because that's how our shows are, everybody. In case you haven't noticed, our shows are heavily prepped with notes and all sorts of pre-planning.
Well, that would be my end of things.
You write.
How do you prep for a show? This is a good question. I don't think anybody has ever asked you this before. How do you prep for one of these shows?
I plug in all the equipment. I'm the engineer of the show, for those who don't know. Phil is a bit of a techno idiot, and I believe you had to come over and steal my monitor just the other day.
I won't techno for an answer.
Hello! Hello! I'm here all week. And then while plugging stuff in, I ponder what inane things you'll say and how I will mock you.
And how do you prep for an improv show?
Ah, same way. I just fill up with rage against you, and off I go. That does seem right.
No, you actually do go through some prep.
I do. Yeah, well,
I've witnessed you. You don't worry about it. You don't worry about it for a long time. And then all of a sudden, like, panic hits in. I got to do a show. How am I going to fill an hour? How am I going to do this thing?
Well, this is the thing. Improv can freak your mind out, because if you think I'm going on stage for an hour without a script, well, then yeah, absolutely freak out. But if you go, okay, I'm going to do this scene and I'll just go from this moment to this moment. And when that happens, then there'll be a variety of options. And then once you have it down like that, then you're set, which is how I do this show.
It is funny though, because you'll like worry about what the story is. Like, what should I do? What's the story? Should I do,
Well, yeah, because the story is a key element. We're storytellers, including improv.
I understand. It's just interesting that after all these years, you still do hit that moment.
Oh, yeah.
Where suddenly you realize you have to dive off the cliff.
Absolutely. And if you ever
and you start grabbing for flotation devices.
We're making sure that you're not going to hit the rocks is right. More important. Not grabbing for flotation devices.
Straight up, not on the rocks. Is how you prepare, what you're saying.
The moment you don't panic about performing is the moment you should stop performing.
Because, of course, yeah.
Right? There should always be that energy of excitement and thrill in the unknown.
Sure.
And if you just walk into it like you're just another day at the cubicle, then why?
I think it's one of the reasons why we continue to do audio tests before each episode of this. Because, really, theoretically, we could mark the mixing board.
Yeah. But, I throw it in that case and then I throw cables on it.
We could mark where everything needs to be.
Yeah.
We could, paper tape it. We could do these things after 3.5 years of doing this show or whatever it's been. We could do that. However, we do get a whole lot of nervous energy out right before the show by doing the audio test.
With lots of laughs. Some of our funniest comedy is the audio
test. That would be hysterical if we'd saved audio tests and just strung those together. There's a bonus feature.
Let us make our New Year's resolution. At the halfway point of our New Year's resolution, we'll start saving audio tests for a lovely bonus CD for all our listeners as a little Christmas gift this year.
That would be funny.
That'd be funny. I already deleted today's, though.
Now, you, literally from here, leave to go... Not out of the country.
No.
Out of the United States, but not out of the country.
No.
The continental U.S.
Yes.
Out of the states, actually.
Technically
out of the territories.
Into the territories. The territory of Puerto Rico.
Often referred to as the 51st state.
I know I
it's
do.
It's never... Is it ever going to be a state? What do you care? You're still Canadian. And when will you stop being Canadian... except by birth and by temperament emphasis on temperament and become an American citizen.
Well,
I
sent my paperwork in.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's over there right now and they're giving it the once old check over. And then I get a note back saying we need your fingerprints. And then from there, I go in for my little interview.
The test. Because I hate the idea that our prep test that we did... couple months back, that you're getting rusty already.
Yeah, I know that so many things have changed in terms of civic discourse in our judicial and executive branches of government that I will now no longer be
able to. What's the third branch of government?
executive, judicial, and legislative.
Okay, you're fine.
Look at you go.
So you're celebrating your birthday?
Yes, I am.
In Puerto Rico?
In San Juan, the old town. I'll be bringing my painting and arts stuff.
You're going to be doing a series of watercolors.
A series of watercolors.
Is it for a good cause?
It is for a good cause.
Well, what's that?
I don't know.
Now, will these count towards the 100 paintings in the year?
I guess they're going to have to because I'm way behind in my 100 paintings of the year. I was thinking there'd be 100 canvases, but in fact, there may be some smaller watercolors because I'm also going to Provence in France in September, so I'll be painting down there as well. So those will count, yeah.
You could always... What do you put the watercolors on?
Paper.
Paper.
Yeah, watercolor paper. I have a lovely little...
Can't you just transfer the paper and tape it to a canvas?
Yeah. Yeah, okay, that's what I'll do. That'll be... you mean just actually cut it out of the
little
sketchbook?
I'm going to listen to that New Year's resolution show.
Yeah.
And I'm going to hear what you said and whether or not it was 100 canvases or whether it was 100 paintings.
I think I just said 100 paintings, didn't I?
I'm going to find out.
Yeah.
We have now referenced this. Apparently, the New Year's resolutions is very much on our mind.
It's technically the halfway point, isn't it?
No, it's technically the 7/12 point because right. This is the last show of July, the 7th month of the year.
I know, but we don't really come to our resolutions till about the 12th of January. So technically, this is...
It would be the first show of the year where we do it.
Yeah, I know.
Hence our New Year's resolutions.
But I don't really kick in to start doing them till 2 weeks later. That's my point.
That's why, indeed, it was quite annoying, us driving around northern British Columbia in the snow, you holding the wheel in one hand and a canvas in the other, the paintbrush in your mouth.
I'm surprised we didn't die.
Oh, sometimes I think we did.
And this is heaven.
You know, speaking of dying and going to heaven.
What'd you see?
It is geek heaven this week and last in San Diego, California.
Yes. Were you down there?
Comic-Con. No, I wasn't.
Right.
Now,
I've gone 7-8 years in a row. I didn't go this year.
You didn't go last year either.
That's right.
I consider myself, in a way, a nerd by proxy.
Because you sit beside me? Is that what this is? Is this just an insult?
Kind of. I mean, think about it. In a lot of ways, I'm sure our listeners could come up with many examples of how I'm nerdy by proxy, in addition to probably some ways in which I'm just plain nerdy. I got no problem with that. But I am nerdy by proxy in a lot of ways. For example, I am not in any way affiliated with the X-Files.
No.
And yet by proxy...
There you are.
I sort of am.
Right.
Knowing many people involved with the X-Files.
Having talked to some of them.
Working with people. I have never been affiliated with Star Trek in any way, and yet having worked with several people
who are
involved in Star Trek. So by proxy, I am associated with these things, seen as nerdy, and things I love.
Uh-huh.
I don't have any particular aim or desire or dream ever to have been a part of those particular franchises,
yeah.
Because I love them. I want to be able to enjoy them.
Right.
I want to be able to be a fan and enjoy the stories well told.
Right. Speaking of sci-fi, listen to that ringtone go.
And so I'm nerdy by proxy, and how it relates to Comic-Con is I have been reading avidly our good friend, occasional... podcast guest, film critic, journalist, actor, Luke Y. Thompson.
Luke Y. Thompson.
Who has been covering Comic-Con in detail for several years now.
Yes.
Through Nikki Fink's Deadline Hollywood.
Yep.
Now known as, what is it, Deadline Daily.
Deadline Daily.
I think it's just deadline.com now, might even be the website. Isn't that amazing?
She bought that out.
But, you know, it's a big deal with a big staff, and Luke Y. Thompson still does the coverage for Comic-Con.
Yep.
And I've been loving it and really getting my geek on and getting, I must admit, excited
really?
By some of these things. And I thought I would share some of the ones that quicken my pulse a little bit.
Let's hear that. Go, begin.
I enjoyed reading about the Expendables panel.
Really?
There's part of me that knows this movie is going to be truly dreadful.
Totally.
In a way that's not fun.
Yeah, I think it's a. I think this movie's against everything you believe in about filmmaking.
And yet, then there's part of me still, that kid within me, who wants to hope that this could be really, really cool shit. The problem is that it is a New Image Millennium movie.
Well, hello. And what, 16 Blocks, that was their only other Bruce Willis hit, right?
Yeah, and that was okay, although it was still
a bit low.
Of that sense that, boy, this is a foreign country they're shooting it in. This is an Eastern Bloc country.
Yeah.
They're being forced to fake things that in a movie like this you wouldn't think that they are. So it'll be interesting to see.
Now, Expendables has every action star known to man all
first
in that movie.
First time that... Schwarzenegger, Stallone, and Bruce Willis have all appeared together, let alone any two of them appearing together.
Which is surprising because I actually voted for him so I'd never have to see another movie with him in it. I didn't know he could do both the governor and...
Surprised that I didn't even know Stallone ran for anything. Attorney General Stallone... Well, may I call you Cobra?
Though his modern art is making waves in the art world.
You have modern action stars like Jet Li and Jason Statham.
Yep.
You have some of the 80s action stars, we'll call them, very much straight to video, like Dolph Lundgren. Who is one of the nicest, most engaging people I've actually worked with. I did a behind the scenes for one of his... action films. And a super smart guy, professor at MIT, for crying out loud.
Holy smokes.
And this is his first film to go theatrical in decades.
Not since he punched out Stallone in
Rocky IV.
Rocky IV as the giant Russian.
No, he did Big Showdown in Little Tokyo, I think was the name of it.
Oh, and what was the other one where he's the robot mercenary?
Universal Soldier. The first one, yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's just a who's who of bizarre action stars. And also like Mickey Rourke, Eric Roberts is in it.
That's awesome.
So it's a...
It's a tough... It must be...
Having grown up in the 80s, come of age in the 80s, there's just so much affection that I automatically have built in for a movie like this. That, yeah, I got my geek on reading the panel.
Still, I gotta think that the dressing room on that set, I don't know, there must have been hilarity. I probably would have enjoyed the behind the scenes of making of the Expendables.
I thought you were about to say that there were a lot of syringes.
Well, yes, that's part of the hilarity. Human growth hormones, I'm sure, were being handed around regularly.
Now, the Avengers, I must admit, I've become just so bored by now because, it was kind of fun that these Marvel movies would have Easter eggs that would all go towards setting up the Avengers.
Yeah.
And I liked it, but the news just got covered so much. And it's almost like the movie comes out, just one of these movies comes out, and it's a small little break from having to hear news about the casting of the Avengers. We've been hearing about this for years.
Yeah.
And, of course, a Thor movie is coming up.
That looks...
And a Captain America movie. Thor is, I think, being directed by Kenneth Branagh.
Yeah.
I forget who's doing Captain America.
I don't remember.
But Chris Evans, who played the Human Torch in another Marvel movie, is now playing Captain America.
I know, which is going to confuse me.
Yeah.
When those...
But that Human Torch role's finally opened up for you.
Really? Yeah. I think they're...
Flame
on, sir!
So I see these photos of the panel... And I get a little bit excited again about it. You know, it's kind of cool seeing Robert Downey Jr. and Samuel L. Jackson and Scarlett Johansson and Jeremy Renner, who's playing Hawkeye. There's interesting casting. Great actor, Jeremy Renner, fresh off the Hurt Locker.
That's right.
And recently signed Mark Ruffalo, who's playing Bruce Banner. And you see all these guys up there and you go, okay, well, this is kind of cool. And then Joss Whedon's directing it.
Yeah, it's a big news.
And so I'm cautiously optimistic about that.
That's two movies I would never think that you would even be optimistic for.
Now, I loved the coverage that Luke presented over a movie that has a lot of kind of cult fervor surrounding it. I don't have really any anticipation towards it, but it's Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some people a very small group of people really love the comic.
Yes.
It's really, really a cult.
Yeah.
It's being directed by Edgar Wright,
yeah,
who did Hot Fuzz, and before that, the Shaun of the Dead.
Yes.
And apparently on the panel, he introduced the cast, and then he introduced also appearing in Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, Simon Pegg and Nick Frost. And they come out like in handcuffs or something. I mean, I don't know. They come out and everybody went nuts because nobody knew that they were in it.
Right. I didn't know they were in it.
And then Edgar Wright then looked at his notes and he goes, oh, I'm sorry, I misread that. It should have been not appearing in Scott Pilgrim versus the World. Simon Pegg and Nick Frost, and the two of them then got these shamed, embarrassed, humiliated looks on their faces and slowly slunk off without saying a thing. They appeared at Comic-Con just for a gag.
Wow. Isn't that pretty elaborate.
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
But I love it because, of course, they are all friends.
They're all friends. In fact, I recall wearing the Shaun of the Dead t-shirt and the whole crew calling me out from the bar going, hey, that's our movie. Hey, they were wearing the thing. And I had to get somewhere, so I didn't get a chance to talk to them. Mm. That's a sad story.
Now, another panel that was hilarious. I hope the movie is hilarious.
Mm.
The Other Guys.
Oh, yeah.
Directed by Adam McKay.
Yeah.
Starring Will Ferrell.
Mm-hmm.
Also starring Mark Wahlberg.
Yeah.
You're not optimistic.
Not optimistic. I'm not feeling it. I'm thinking that the funny has been sold out in the trailer, and perhaps it's the man-boy thing that you're tired of. And I don't know. I don't know. I'm going to hold
out. I certainly feel like the panel was probably worth the price of admission, which I guess would have been free, just waiting in line early.
Yes, exactly.
But hopefully the movie is. I have no desire to see this particular film, but there's a thing called Drive Angry shot in 3D, and that's actually the name of it. It's not Drive Angry 3D or Drive Angry in 3D. It's Drive Angry shot in 3D, starring Nick Cage. And reading Luke Y. Thompson's just absolute insane love of all things Nick Cage, almost like, and it's very self-aware.
Yeah,
you know, it's like almost the worst and the crazier he gets. Like he even writes so much as the worse the wig is, the more he loves it. And so Nick Cage appeared on this panel talking about this film, and he said that he was very attracted to the idea of 3D, wanting to know, quote, what moves I could do that might go into the fourth row of the audience. And Luke wrote, dude, you do that already in 2D.
Oh,
hilarious.
What moves I could do that could go into the fourth row of the audience.
Now, here's something that I had not bothered to look into at all. I don't know about the comic book.
Okay.
I'd heard the name of the film and goes, oh, this sounds kind of lame.
Yeah.
Then I see a photo from the film of Daniel Craig.
Ooh.
As a cowboy.
What? What's the film?
And then I hear that Harrison Ford, for the first time ever, appears on a Comic-Con panel.
What?
To promote the currently shooting Cowboys and Aliens.
Oh, yeah. And Cowboys and Aliens.
I am
intrigued.
I'm apeshit crazy in anticipation of this thing.
Really?
And it's only shooting now.
Wow. Yeah, Cowboys and Aliens. I forget who did the comic.
I think Jon Favreau might be directing that.
Really? That would be cool.
And he's done a very good job with the Iron Man movies.
I liked what he did with the Iron Man movies. I think, you know what? I actually may have Cowboy and Alien comic books here.
Ooh.
I may have that because I know.
I don't know if I want to know anything about it. Oh, I think I want to come fresh to it.
Yeah, okay. Because I recall reading that some years ago. Anyway,
so those
are your big ones.
Yeah, those are the ones, and I was getting my geek on this week, again, by proxy.
Yeah, right. I was getting all the Twitter feeds, of course, keeping up, including the guy who got stabbed in the eye with a pen because of the seating. And of course,
was it really an eye?
Well, it was in between his eye and his ear, so it was like close.
I heard temple. Neck for a while.
Yeah. No, then it was I, and then somebody said, but in true Comic-Con fashion, he came back dressed as Cyclops. Ah, good one. No?
Too soon.
He wasn't hurt, apparently, though.
So what'd you find out for us, long-standing listener question, what'd you find out for us about how directors get hired for television?
Ah, excellent. Well, I gave a call to Vince, and I'm waiting to hear back.
At least that happens.
Yeah.
All right. So I'll press you on that 3 weeks from now when we next do a live show.
It's nay on the, what we're doing, on the, which one's recorded and which one's live.
Yeah. But I do know that we have two fabulous guests each of the next
Oh, it's going to be fantastic. We have guests coming in.
Yeah. Excited. So we'll talk about that maybe at the end of the show.
Maybe, if we so desire.
All right. Other listener questions.
Yes.
It's going to be, we're going to probe into the mystery.
Ooh.
Who is Dean Haglund?
What?
Yes.
That's not a mystery.
Okay.
My Facebook page is open to thousands of people.
I've told you, right, that in the About the Filmmakers section of the bonus features for the DVD,
yeah,
when they click on you, I'm going to just create a like a warning, like a thing that you've hit, like that's wrong. And it says, if you want to know about Dean Haglund, watch the movie you've just purchased. Yeah,
exactly.
It's all about him.
That's all about me. I am an open book. But let us probe the mystery.
We got a question from John Bailey, listener of ours.
Yeah. Dear John Bailey.
Asks.
I asked him, won't he come home?
About.
I bet he hears that all the time.
Whether or not we know Lorena Gale.
Lorena
Gale. She was in, according to him, a few X-Files and in I Wanna Believe.
Yeah.
I have not verified either of those things.
What?
Because, really, she was in Scooby-Doo, The Mystery Begins. And in that film says... Huzzah! So
really?
John Bailey's question, having listened long enough to know that you often say, huzzah,
yep.
Is it possible that you got that from her?
Ah, the answer is no.
And if not, where did you get that?
Well, I will tell you, as my days in Vancouver theater sports, up in Vancouver, where we improvised all the time, there was many a fellow improviser, Ryan Stiles, Colin Mochrie, big names, Ian Boothby.
Gary Jones.
Gary
Ian
Jones.
Boothby.
Ian Boothby. And one whom may you never heard of named Roger Fredericks. Roger Fredericks is a brilliant writer who hates being on camera, hates all improvised. He thinks no improvised comedy should never be filmed or videotaped or anything because that is a live medium and that should survive in the live realm. And that it is, he was one of the first writers to come out.
He won't like our documentary.
No, he won't. No, in fact, that's true. But he was the first one to start saying huzzah as a throwback to the 1920s when we were all using catchphrases from the 20s as a way of expressing hilarity in the dressing room at theater sports. So I think we predate Lorena Gale's huzzah by maybe 10 years.
Right, and huzzah in Scooby-Doo may very well have been a scripted line.
Right.
One might think.
Right, which at that point I would have to credit to Roger Fredericks.
Well, unless he maybe didn't write Scooby-Doo, The Mystery Begins.
No, he wrote straight-to-video Casper, the Friendly Ghost.
Interesting. He may then have something to do with Scooby-Doo.
I'm saying.
Okay, well.
There you go. Does that answer that?
So
I'm glad we probed that mystery.
F.E.D., our listener from Greece.
Oh, yes.
The artist now known as F.E.D., actually wrote a question. She's a little put out with me because she wrote a question.
I would say. I'm put out with
weeks
you.
Ago that I said I was going to ask you on air.
And, oh, right.
And I did not.
Because you're shy? You're shy.
Because you've talked about this before.
Oh, right.
And... I'm sometimes hesitant to revisit
questions that we've
knowingly heard. Things that we've talked about before because God knows we repeat ourselves enough without knowing it.
I don't think we ever repeat ourselves, frankly. I think we.
I'm sorry. Could you repeat that?
We talk in circles, but it's not necessarily repeating.
No, we've shared the same stories many times, and it's all right because, of course, listeners come and listeners go.
What? Who left?
But our stories, they remain sparklingly fresh forever. Anyway, here's what she wrote. And
okay.
This is, I'm just going to read the entire little question from her. Dean Haglund,
hello.
In a recent interview, that's you, Dean Haglund, in a recent interview
really?
With Jack Blood of American Freedom Radio.
Mm-hmm.
Was that recent?
I think, sure.
Okay, like when she wrote me this question, it probably
Just happened, like a month ago, yeah.
You said in that interview,
okay,
that there is a U.S. military FBI meeting held in Hollywood every year that yep. screenwriters can attend to learn about FBI / military protocol.
Yep.
So that they can give an accurate portrayal of procedure in their screenplays.
True.
Could you provide some more information on these meetings?
Having never attended.
So the answer would be no.
No. Well, I read about it at L.A. Times, Los Angeles Times newspaper.
Oh.
It gave a three-page article on the writer who attended with all the other writers. And who got up to speak and all that sort of thing.
So you've just answered the question, can you tell us more? And you also answered her last question, which was, have you yourself ever attended one?
Right.
The middle question.
Damn it, I thought I could psychically answer them all in one sentence.
You came very close. When are they held and how does one apply to attend such a meeting?
Excellent. That I don't know. I would imagine a web search would be a good place, or perhaps the WGA, because it seemed that it was a Writers Guild of America sponsored event.
Interesting.
Yeah. So
Interesting.
It would be a unionized
but
deal.
You read this article in the Los Angeles Times.
I did. I did indeed. And that this was a thing. And then that story was put, shuttled off. And then other people thought that this was a propaganda machine that was a way of shutting down any whistleblower anti-war script. Which I perhaps agree,
To a degree, I think, obviously, and I don't think there's any problem with this. I mean, the example, we've talked about this before, and I don't know whether it was on the show or in a panel discussion or what, but to a certain degree, we would be really shocked and probably disappointed if it wasn't that,
mm-hmm.
because the example that we gave was, if we rent our house out to a production crew to make a movie there, we're not going out of our way to say, would you please show the bodies in the basement? Would you please show the dry rot?
Yeah, exactly.
Or the things that, no,
yeah,
we want to know that you're going to show it in a good light.
Right.
And as individuals, we would want that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, the FBI, the CIA, the military, the police department, how about the Dirty Harry movies? Not the fifth one, the Deadpool, but the one before that, which was the biggest hit of them all up until that point, Sudden Impact, was the first one that couldn't be made in San Francisco. And they didn't get it permitted, and they weren't getting cooperation from the police department because it was kind of a new era now in the 80s. And the city police department said, we don't really want our police department image to be that of Dirty Harry.
Well, and it's true. It's so funny how movies permeate the culture. I have two Dobermans, right? I walk down the street. Once a day, somebody goes, hey, you gonna go rob some banks? Hey, it's the Doberman gang. Now, this apparently was a 1974 Disney movie or something where five Dobermans rob a bank. Now, their Dobermans aren't very greedy. They like their food, but they don't really want to rob banks.
You get stopped. This is now a pattern emerging of times you get stopped of being accused of being a bank robber.
Yes, me and my dogs.
But also this happened as we were discussing off air in Vancouver.
Vancouver, yep.
Right outside a police station.
Exactly. When I had longer hair, of course. And this is the thing. So this is why I'm surprised that they're remaking All Quiet on the Western Front. This has just been announced. And All Quiet on the Western Front was a World War I diatribe against soldiers coming back from the trenches that didn't have the heroism and the glory of war, but were traumatized by mustard gas. And, it was that evolution from turn-of-the-century ideas of fighting war and the actual reality of a mechanized 20th-century war where it was not man against man, but machine and gas and all these sort of things.
Well, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. So that I'm surprised they're doing that now at a time when, drones are out there. I don't know if they're updating the movie or what, but it was a shock to me to hear that even got greenlit.
Yeah. I was wondering, did the X-Files, did the writers on the X-Files, did they ever attend anything like this? Was there direct cooperation with the FBI?
There was FBI consultants early on, and there was many an FBI personnel that came up to me asking that very question, because they said you get a lot of it very correct, a lot of it's very right.
And of course in El Paso, when we were driving through there, you pointed out the FBI building where you were given a tour.
A tour. There's pictures of me on Facebook with the FBI full flak jacket.
And I would think that Vince Gilligan has been getting full cooperation from the DEA, I would think.
I would think. Because they're all shown in a good light in that.
Yeah, he says that, what did he say, that the mayor's office has been very, very
in Albuquerque?
The police not so happy.
Right.
But I would think the DEA would be...
pretty happy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's anytime you're showing crime in a town...
You know, I often have real compassion, especially as we investigate and immerse ourselves in all these conspiracies. I have great compassion for anyone that works for any government organization.
Institution?
You know, because, you know, unless you think that every single person is involved in whatever conspiracy you believe in.
Right.
What a shitty position you have put all these people in, because, you know, they're going to be confronting... I just sometimes I wonder how these people go to work.
Well, this is, you know, where it's the Justice Department, because those clerks and lawyers and people who have come through legal school have really gone into the Justice Department for the, you know, there is the compound to do good. There is this heroic need to be part of, you know, that whole thing.
And the the hardest part has to be for any of these things, whether you're in the military, whether you're in police or the Justice Department or anything where the collective opinion of it has been colored by something external.
Yes.
Be it films, television, media, the news, but colored by something external to the work you're doing. And yet that's generally how the world is engaging you. It's got to be the hardest part of the job.
Yeah.
I would think.
I would think so.
And so therefore that brings us back to kind of the innocent side of this desire, which is how best to engage with it. Well, say, you know what? We would like to open our doors and make what we do available to your depiction
right.
in it. We would, of course, appreciate... perhaps you show some of the positive things that we do.
Right. But at the same time, then you go, okay, if I am a writer and I am horrified by the way the war in Afghanistan, for instance, is going on, and I want to make a movie that exemplifies that horror, and then I go and I have to use, you know, inflatable tanks and CGI guns because I can't get any props from the prop department because all of that is military. You know, there's a funny
We're
protocol.
We're going to talk about a documentary that hits on that topic completely in just a few minutes.
Really?
I've got one more question for the listener for you.
Hit me.
Stephen D. Fowler wrote and asked
out of Revelstoke, British Columbia.
Yes, and we drove through
Revelstoke. We had a lovely breakfast there.
Lovely organic meal. Mm. Stephen D. Fowler asked, has Dean ever told you how he got that scar on his forehead? And the thing is, you have, and I don't remember. And I want to know, do I not remember because it was so horrific that I blocked it out?
Probably. It was spectacularly horrific. For those who don't know, I have a 22-stitch, 14 on the outside, 8 on the inside, right down to my skull on my right to temporal lobe, just above the temporal artery by maybe a millimeter, which was probably
at least it was in a place that you don't use.
Hilarious. No, Stephen Fowler and I were actors in Vancouver in 1990, I believe. Maybe it was 89. And it was the play was called The Comedy of Oedipus, You'll Put Your Eye Out. Hilarious right there. And
set at Comic-Con.
That was the Vancouver Fringe Festival. And I was putting away the props by myself at my studio, which were the giant Roman columns, and one slid over. And as I corrected it to stop it from falling over, I knocked a mirror off the wall, which was about 15 feet at the top part of the...
Now, is a mirror a fellow performer?
No, a mirror.
Oh, you mean a big glass mirror.
Yeah.
Mirror. Yeah, okay.
My Canadian accent says mirror.
A mirror. Amir, I know many actors named Amir. I knocked him off the wall, and he was pissed.
Amir O'Rourke. Thank you. Mirror. Yes, that came down, snapped, and it's...
You're not going to get your American citizenship with that kind of pronunciation, pal.
Jesus. Okay, when did you become dickhead of pronunciation? I don't know when that happened. Anyway, it sliced my head open. I had 10 minutes before.
See,
bled to death.
Deflecting right now, yeah. Because I do remember the story now.
Yeah. It went down to my skull. My skull was actually exposed. I took my shorts and applied it to my head, and I had a choice of whether to drive to the hospital or go get my girlfriend. And I decided at 3 o'clock in the morning, or 2 a.m., to go get my girlfriend, and at which point I'd stemmed the blood enough. But apparently she said that when I said, does this look bad, and removed the shorts, my entire face was hanging off my skull. And so we went to the hospital, and they were going to give me 13 stitches, but I said, I just broke a mirror. Can I get 14 so I don't have more bad luck? And that was that story right there. Good one. That's why you blocked it out. You can't stand these stories.
I can't stand that.
And in fact, it was a teaching hospital, so they left it open, and all the medical students had to come by one because it was such clean incisions through all the layers down to the skull that all the students had to come to see what it looks like with all the proper layers.
So why does this not, and this is a fantastic patterning in your life, why does this not disturb you? Why can you watch your own knee surgery on video? Why does this not? Yeah, I mean, I think now about times when I've like cut a finger all the way down to the bone and could see the bone, and I start to swim out of consciousness now thinking about it. Why do you enjoy that?
I'm not sure, because I could disassociate myself from it, huh? Is that what you're going to say, Mr. Psychology?
No. I was actually going to get into, use it as a segue into my next topic, which was having finished one of your favorite books, Secret Supper, about Leonardo da Vinci. And I just thought that, you know, it's interesting because da Vinci is one of your big heroes.
Yeah.
And did he not do the first, at least the first renowned or first I heard, anatomical depictions of human beings based on cadavers.
Cadavers, yeah. Well, a lot of artists at the time were doing some cadaver work to see the muscles under the skin. Apparently, it was more common than they said. The church was against it, but that you could go and artists at different studios would do that to learn about the body. But then Leonardo went past the muscles and down into basically he was searching for the soul. He believed the soul existed somewhere in the brain, and he would pour wax into the brain cavity and find, apparently in our brain, there's two empty caverns that he believed the soul existed in.
Actually, I now have a psychological theory about you.
Finally!
Yes, because, and I think that this might explain in some ways our partnership and our friendship.
Oh.
I was in, Washington, D.C.
Yes, you were.
And I saw one of these statues in the sculpture garden, and it's the giant rabbit thinker, the black rabbit thinker.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, it's like Rodin, but it's a rabbit.
And the first time I saw it, and it's a skinny, tall, scary-looking rabbit. And the first time I saw it, I looked at it. I'd never heard of it before. I'd never seen it. I looked at it, I go, that's terrifying. And I sounded horrified, and I ran right towards it. That's terrifying. I need to see it. And you had a real recurring childhood terror, did you not? That when you would leave the room...
You're blowing the best part of the documentary, aren't you?
No, I mean, it's a thing. It's a thing okay. in the documentary, but I mean, it's...
Lyle loves this, but yeah.
But we can't
not talk about it.
Yeah, we can't deny our loyal listeners their Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. You had this fear when you were a boy that when you left the room, people. Oh, perfect timing.
Perfect timing. Now I'm really scared.
That all people's skin and flesh would come off and they would just be skeletons.
Yeah.
And then right before you would re-enter the room, that they would zip back up.
Yeah. That their natural form was in skeletal form, and that they were just putting on the skin and all that for my sake.
And that terrified you, which explains to me why then you're not bothered by the experience of having your own skin and flesh hang off, why you can watch the knee surgery, why these works of Leonardo, why these things, because
It does terrify you. And we are wired in such a way that we are drawn to what terrifies us. This gets back to your comment, and I think it's absolutely true, about performing. When you get to the point where you're not, when you don't have that moment of terror, that's when you know it's time to hang it up.
Right. That it's like, well, it's no longer, there's no juice
you're
alive.
You're not a performer anymore because there is no juice in it.
Right.
Right.
And, interesting.
And that is true for everybody, though, to a certain degree. Where there's fear, there is desire.
Ah, now we come down to the Freudian. Isn't that...
I don't know. But I had no intention of going there with this discussion. Exactly. It just occurred to me.
But this was supposed to be a segue to something.
To Leonardo.
Oh,
and
right.
The Secret Supper.
Ah, yes. Love that book.
I found this to be just such a sloppy book.
So was Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code.
Right, but that's your that is... If you're saying that this is one of the best books you've read because it's better than Dan Brown...
Okay.
Yeah, I mean...
Okay, it's sloppy, but the ideas are phenomenal.
Well, and here's the thing. Okay, so the writing is sloppy, and in part I think it's translation, but also in part it's narrative shifts. You shift point of view of narrators, and
three different times.
And but then you find out it's all supposed to be from the same narrator.
Yeah, that was
but
shocking.
But he uses first and third person, sometimes in inappropriate ways, according to the rules of grammar. So there's so
that's
there's
a translation there. Yeah.
But yes, the ideas are fabulous. And it's a really quite a bad book. And it's, I think, because the motivation was entirely because of the ideas that the man wanted to express. Rather than, oh, I know what would be a great story to tell. Instead, he researched for years all these topics and then figured out a story
to try
with which
to deliver
these things.
So it's
and
a crappy
that,
delivery vehicle of
and
some
that
cool
brings
ideas.
Us right back to Dan Brown in a way. The difference, and I'm wondering whether this is why, for example, you love The Secret Supper and you dismiss Dan Brown, is because you could tell that this writer actually loves the ideas that he's expressing.
Yeah.
As opposed to Dan Brown, who loves how many copies of the book these ideas are going to sell.
Right. That's interesting. Yeah, well, I think that love of those ideas for those...
The ideas nourish because they're nourishing to the author.
Right. And for the reader, too.
And, well, because of that. Because
right.
of that. Whereas in Dan Brown, the ideas expressed aren't nourishing. I mean, some might be pleasing. They're not nourishing. It right. really is fast food.
Yeah,
versus
absolutely.
A genuine meal.
Particularly when each chapter is a page and a half long. And,
well, you get on that, don't you?
Yeah, sure do.
But so talk to me then about a little bit. I had ambivalence even towards the ideas, though.
Oh,
in this,
the idea that each apostle has an astronomical.
Well, I don't know how far into this we should get.
Yeah,
but
you're
this,
right.
But this
everybody
idea,
read it and then get back to us.
But this idea that all of Da Vinci's work had encoded within it through his very precise mathematical approach
right.
to art had messages included in them.
Right.
These are not necessarily conspiratorial messages. We don't even need to get into that, but... Do you find that to be true in Da Vinci's art?
Yes. I mean, there is... you can find, for instance, in the Venusian Man, which is the guy standing in the circle in the square, that there's actual math to proportions that works out to a mathematical formula regarding human proportions and stuff, and that he expresses that in a piece of art that you can then go back and forth on that.
Well, yeah, and what is the golden ratio?
There's the golden ratio, but that's from the Greek era.
Right.
All that stuff. The other idea also is that...
he applied that.
Yes, right. He did.
Again, in his mathematical approach to these
right.
things.
Right, which is why it took him, you know, to consider that he only painted 15 paintings in his lifetime.
So this is the reason that I don't know, maybe ambivalence is not the right word. Maybe what I'm finding is perhaps an explanation for why I've never cared for any of Da Vinci's work.
Oh,
None of it breathes.
What?
Yeah, none of it resonates.
Come on, I got a book full of...
For me, no, oh. None of it does.
Did you go to the Getty to see the Da Vinci?
Did you? And the thing is, like this, The Last Supper especially so...
Doesn't breathe?
No, because I find it to be all about the ideas that are obviously trying to be expressed. And so it isn't about inspiration. It's about inspiration. Oddly enough, it's a painting about inspiration that is not inspired, that is instead constructed. And
yeah, I'm sort of following this line of thought. But
Da Vinci isn't an artist. Da Vinci is a mathematician. He's an architect.
At the time in the Renaissance when all of that was one and the same. Art, math, science, architecture.
But it wasn't one and the
same. Yes, it were.
Certainly it was not Michelangelo's approach. Which is the basis, I would think, of your play.
Well, exactly. But his approach, he did actually approach it sculpturally. So he was working in three-dimensional form. So he would approach painting in the same way he'd approach sculpture in the illusion of three dimensions. But that also, when you think about David, that David was a block of concrete with a hole or a big gouge at the side, and that nobody could carve with it because it had to have a human form twist around this hole that was there for 25 years. Therefore, he was using spatial relation, geometry, in order to figure out how to carve David. He just didn't start going at it.
So this is, why, though, I would find Da Vinci and his work interesting. Uh-huh. As opposed to
inspiring
or pleasing or scintillating.
Who do you find? Okay, well, I need now a new
baseline. I tend towards more surrealist anyway. You know, I mean, my favorites being Magritte, for example.
Okay. You don't find Magritte construction formulated? This is not a pipe, an apple in front of the guy's head. Oh, you don't see that as a construction. You see
right,
that,
but I feel it dropping into using the construction, building the playground wherein you can drop into the unconscious.
Ah, so you need some tapping to a deeper
which I think is one of the purposes of art.
Right. Whereas
I find Da Vinci his work not to serve as art rather than to serve as his own form of propaganda. And this is why I ask you about the ideas in the book. This is why I ask you about the ideas in the book. Because if you accept the ideas in the book,
mm-hmm.
then as the book argues, he was not motivated as an artist by the need to express. He was motivated by as a perfect man, as a true believer in Christ, as a member of the true church, to express the, for lack of a better word, liturgy of that church in a way that that church would allow, which is through art, which is counter to the church of the time. So his motivation was what we would call propaganda.
Yeah. Okay. But now let's go to the Mona Lisa, for instance. Here's
which that book argues is also the same.
Well, but you say that then, are you telling me that doesn't drop into a subconscious or unconscious?
No, and
for the viewer, you're not taking...
I've yet to meet anyone that actually is moved by the Mona Lisa.
Well, because there's always 80 people taking a photograph in front of it.
Yeah.
But it is kind of cool.
I mean, I still don't get what the deal is.
The mysterious, are you kidding? It's this fantastic painting.
It's a dude and it's a woman. Again, it's all about the ideas and it's all about the encoding of the ideas that he's trying to express.
Yeah, okay.
It doesn't tap into my unconscious. It taps into his consciousness.
Which came from an unconscious... Well, you're right.
You gotta admit that I've got gigantic balls to be taking on the legacy of Leonardo da Vinci.
That guy's an ass. He's no artist.
I'm just throwing some ideas out here because these are clearly the ideas that are being expressed in the book.
Yeah.
And this is where my ambivalence lies, is that I would never have claimed that Da Vinci was not an artist. However, if you accept these ideas that the author is expressing, really what he's describing is propaganda.
Hmm. But all
and
artists...
And he's championing them.
The Sistine Chapel, all of these things are also propaganda. It was the only way for artists to get work at the time. In the Renaissance, it was the church that paid for the artists. So, yes, agreed.
It's fine. It doesn't make it not propaganda, though, which, again, is why it doesn't resonate with me.
So you don't find anything till Hieronymus Bosch, he's the surrealist from the 1500s that finally tapped into some unconscious that he was the first artist.
No, I'm saying that that's why I don't think Avatar is a movie.
because propaganda.
The ideas are so beautiful doesn't make it a movie.
I see.
There isn't a story.
Right. Whereas you would love Salt, which I saw this weekend.
Well, we have so much to discuss. You watched the season premiere of Mad Men?
I did not.
It's back. It's so good.
I got it on TiVo. I think it just picked up.
The season premiere, and it's, you know, it's a reboot. They rebooted at the end of last year. So great. So great. I mean, the ending of last night's episode, season premiere, had me just dying that we weren't getting another episode right away.
Okay.
But they've got a long-term deal in the works, Mad Men.
How long?
At AMC. Well, they certainly have one more year, but they're working on at least a two-year extension.
Look at that.
With Matthew Weiner, so things look good there.
Sweet.
There was a headline, though, that I wanted to discuss that was about... Oh, yeah, the headline, Deadline Hollywood again. Do cable dramas scheduling patterns give them an Emmy advantage? And that was the headline. And I really didn't need to get into the analysis of it because it didn't matter to me what side they came down on, whether the scheduling patterns allow for an Emmy advantage, when we know that most of this voting gets done on tapes and discs that are submitted.
So it's not like somebody's like, oh, I got to watch that tonight.
Right. Although I'm sure that helps to a certain degree.
Because you just talked about the premiere.
But isn't it all the other things that we've discussed before that give cable dramas an Emmy advantage, which is because you know you're going after a smaller slice of the pie in terms of audience size to begin with, then you can concentrate on pleasing that slice of the pie.
Absolutely.
Look, these are the people who are coming to interesting, innovative, unusual stories. So you know what? All we have to do is give them interesting, innovative, authentic, unusual stories.
Absolutely.
As opposed to, how do we keep 30 million people a week happy?
Well, and this is what Vince said when we interviewed him about Breaking Bad, which is an AMC movie as well. I go, you know, is it like the days of the X-Files where you had four writers, but one of them was always battling executives on every freaking storyline and page, and the other three are left to write the actual scripts? And he said, no, there's like the execs hardly give notes at AMC. He's allowed to be expressive and as creative as all he wants. The legal department, of course, takes a look at it. But it sounds like he is given absolute freedom to create a spectacular TV series without a series of suits, as it's known, coming down.
And when you have that, then you're going to attract, are you not, the best writers and the best actors?
Absolutely.
You're going to actually cast actors who are right for the part, as opposed to, okay, we need to get a name in here. We need to get the big sweep bump.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah. So all of that you could see now is coming to play finally, because all the best shows, even TV Land doing Hot in Cleveland with Betty White. I hate to say it, I'm watching that show.
I want to see that.
I'm actually seeing episodes of that, and I'm sitting all the way through them, which I don't do with the big four sitcoms that I can never sit through.
Yeah, I don't even really do it for Modern Family. I mean, if I was on a plane, I would watch Modern Family, and I would go, okay, but this isn't particularly necessarily authentic and unusual or innovative.
Yeah.
So anyway. Okay, so tell me about Salt.
Salt, what an action movie. Oh, you know what? I think all action movies from now on should have hot chicks as the lead.
Well, you know, she replaced Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
She was a casting replacement for Tom Cruise, set a record for payday for a woman, and then turns out to apparently be worth every penny of it because she's been tireless in her efforts to promote it, in addition to the performance that she gives.
And she brings in her own stunt coordinator, which I realized, here's the smartest thing you could ever do. Make your stunt coordinator second unit director. Because he's doing both duties. This Simon Kring guy, he's worked with her since...
Well, that usually is...
Not always.
No, you're right. Not always.
I've seen that where it's come really bad, because the stunt coordinator will figure out some really cool move, like, you know, disarm two guys in a narrow hallway. And then the second unit guy will go, okay, we'll just do a crane shot from the ceiling running the length of the hallway. And you go, but I'm doing all this cool stuff on the floor, and all that gets lost.
I'm seeing it in 2 weeks.
Yep.
The supporting cast, I love it.
Oh, Lee Shriver is great in this thing.
So is Chiwetel Ejiofor, I mentioned, is one of my all-time favorites. I mean, when we did our list of our favorite actors, there's several of them in this movie.
Look at that. This movie's made for you.
So you definitely recommend everyone to see it.
Yep.
Is there going to be a sequel?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yep.
Don't worry. Is a new franchise.
Franchise spectacular.
Have you seen The Inception?
No.
I saw The Inception. Three words. Saved the summer.
Really? You loved it. I was thinking you wouldn't dig it.
Oh, my goodness.
Really?
Maybe one of my top five favorite sci-fi films.
Come on.
All time.
Stop it.
Great cast, especially Tom Hardy, old friend Tom Hardy.
Yeah.
Who we've known, everybody probably knows him best, I guess, still is Shinzon in Star Trek Nemesis, the Star Trek movie that killed the franchise for a while. But he's a great guy and such a good actor. And he just blows the roof off the dump in this movie. He's so good.
I'm going.
The entire cast is great.
Cinemark. I'm going.
It's a fantastic
film. I'm seeing it.
Film.
Stop it. What else you going to see?
I saw Cyrus. Finally caught this film.
The comedy with Jonathan.
John C. Reilly.
Yeah.
Marissa Tomei.
Mr.
Catherine
Hill.
Keener. And unfortunately, Jonah Hill.
Yeah.
I say unfortunately, not because Jonah Hill is bad in it, but because he's too much nail on the head.
Ooh.
It is such a relief and a joy to get to see John C. Reilly and Marissa Tomei play these roles and given another chance to really,
do their stuff.
Dig into rich material. And doing their stuff for both of them involves really showing all of themselves, the vulnerability, the ugliness, the pettiness, and celebrating these things. I mean, that's what their work does at its best. And Marissa Tomei, who's been now around for a couple of decades.
Yeah.
This is a woman that the older she gets, seriously, the more gorgeous she gets because she doesn't cling to any idea of youthful beauty.
Ah.
In fact, she just chooses these roles that let her dig deeper into what she's made of to show more eccentricity, more vulnerability. And lo and behold,
look hotter for it.
Leading to her aging not only gracefully but really becoming radiant.
Wow.
In the process. I mean, The Wrestler and now especially Cyrus. But the problem with Jonah Hill is it's a casting that's very too much nail on the head.
Right.
But if you're interested in an indie comedy that is both authentic and uncomfortable.
Really?
It's very nice, and what's wonderful about it is that you're watching two different relationships in the film. And they're the same relationship. So it's very nice.
What do you know?
Saw a couple others. Saw Sorcerer's Apprentice. Now, I talked about Geek by Proxy and how much, the boy inside of me was geeking off on Expendables and stuff like this. The boy inside me loves The Sorcerer's Apprentice, loves a movie like this.
And the filmmaker? Yeah, okay. Say no more. We're out of time.
But it failed. It's failed. And the reason that it's failed, I think, is because there's no significant female mixing it up in any of these things. Because you look at it,
you know,
a big Disney film with Bruckheimer and Nick Cage and sorcerers.
Yeah.
Why isn't that not a big hit? And I think it's because there's nothing in it that's an in to young girls.
I would say as much.
And that's really important. It's just stunning to me how many of these films that are supposedly family films don't understand that you need to give an in both to young boys
and
to young girls.
Right.
In talking about Sorcerer's Apprentice, though, and the way that Disney cross-markets all these things, we're basing this movie on a scene from Fantasia.
Yeah, right.
And they bring, and that's the best part of the movie, is recreating that scene.
Oh, they do. Okay.
But, they're taking they base Pirates of the Caribbean on a ride.
Yeah.
They're taking another stab at Haunted Mansion as a movie based on the ride.
On the ride.
And it's going to be Guillermo del Toro.
I heard that.
Now that he's freed up not doing The Hobbit movies, he's going to do Haunted Mansion. And you go, why is the guy who made Pan's Labyrinth, why does he have to do Haunted Mansion?
Right.
Why this?
Because he signed a 3-picture deal?
Well, I was thinking about something that Michel Gondry, who did write Eternal Sunshine, didn't he?
Yeah.
But anyway, he's...
did the new Green Hornet movie, which is being redone as 3D.
Yeah, I'm worried.
And they
worried.
Asked him, like, why did you do the Green Hornet? Did you have an affection for this? And really, he said, look, there were visual ideas that I had that I could only do with a really big budget. So the only way you're going to get a really big budget is by doing a franchise comic book movie. So there you go. Now you get to do your ideas.
Right.
And I'm not saying he's wrong. I mean, that's not, again, being driven by a story.
True.
But you are trapped in these visual ideas. But again, maybe what will come out of it years down the road is he will have worked through these ideas and figured out how to make those work in a story that matters to him.
That could be. There's always hope.
Finally, I saw this documentary that probably will win the Oscar for Best Documentary.
Ooh.
Restrepo, about an outpost in the Korangal Valley in Afghanistan that the U.S. military established, named for one of their fallen comrades. And these filmmakers, it's a National Geographic documentary,
ooh,
and these filmmakers were embedded with this platoon during their 15-month deployment in the most dangerous place on the planet, where they were under fire at least once every single day. For 15 months. And it's going to win an Oscar, and it's truly a dreadful, dreadful documentary. And why it's a dreadful documentary is that it has absolutely no point of view whatsoever.
Interesting.
When we talk about point of view, you know, it's a very tricky thing with a documentary because, again, it is never objective. It is always subjective. It always has the point of view of the filmmakers. And you try not to hide that point of view.
Right.
But also you don't want to impose that point of view. It needs to be part of the mix.
Right.
And when I say point of view, sometimes it's as simple as the questions you're asking. These are why we're asking these questions, and that's why we're making this film.
Right.
And I walked away not having a clue what questions these people asked. Even if the question is, what's it like to be in war?
Yeah.
That certainly doesn't get answered.
Isn't that funny?
And I wonder if it is because to make that film, you need the full cooperation of the military.
I bet that has something to do with it.
And we'll of talk course, all National about Geographic. So
we'll get into that more. I'm going to come and see that film. We'll talk more about that next week.
Well, no, we won't next week. Next week we have a special guest.
Oh yes.
And
the week after that's a special guest.
Another special guest.
We have two special guests back to back.
Exciting.
Excellent.
Stay tuned for those. You can find every episode this podcast, which is your Chilpack Hollywood Hour, at our official website, chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, Hollywood.com. Download us, stream us, subscribe to us via iTunes there from that site.
You can
There's
do
a
it.
Link.
Easy.
Become a fan of the show on Facebook. Or a liker.
A
liker. I'm sorry.
Like us.
702 likers. Can't be wrong. On Facebook. Facebook.com/ChillpackHollywood. A friend of the show on MySpace. MySpace.com/ChillpackHollywood. You can always hear the most recent show on there. And in the blog, each weekend, we post a preview of the coming show. So if you are dying to find out who next week's guest is, Sunday, check out the MySpace blog. MySpace.com/ChillpackHollywood. And you'll find out.
There it is.
What else am I forgetting? You're on Twitter.
I'm on Twitter at D. Haglin.
Are you going to tweet in Puerto Rico?
I might, though I'm a little pissed off with the technology, as you saw on my Facebook. Yeah.
So we'll see. And I'm twitter.com/PhilLarenis. One thing that makes anyone far less pissed off, in my experience, at the technology, especially when that technology is your laptop.
Yes.
Is the ChillPack.
Look at that.
The ChillPack is a gel pack cooling device that is environmentally friendly, easy to use, inexpensive, less than $30 with free shipping anywhere in the world.
In the world!
And it takes your laptop computer and it keeps it running fast, increases its longevity by keeping it cool. Check it out at chillpack.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K.com.
Till next week.
I'm Phil Larry.
I'm Dean Haglin.